Hey, it's Melissa from Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600, and thanks for checking out the podcast right here. If you want, you can always subscribe, share, and like it. Hope to see you guys soon. Thanks.
We've learned this week in talking to Deb Greenwood from the Center for Family Justice that we've seen a major uptick in domestic violence situations, especially since the beginning of the pandemic. And during Domestic Violence Awareness Month, we really wanted to focus on different aspects of this topic. And today I wanted to talk about the laws on the books, essentially. So this morning joining me is Angela Schlinghide, who is the Center for Family Justice's Director of Civil Legal Services and Criminal Court Advocacy. Angela, welcome to the show. Good morning. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you, Melissa. How are you?
I'm good. First of all, Angela, did I botch your name? Because I pride myself on never doing that.
No, you said it perfectly. Thank you.
Oh, thank
goodness. Thank you for having me this morning.
No problem. I appreciate you being here. I wanted to talk about recent laws on the books in Connecticut, maybe some improvements we could see. What are we lacking? What are we doing well in Connecticut to better protect victims of domestic violence? So let's start with the good, right? Let's start with the good. I know in recent years, Connecticut, the one that sticks out to me, Angela, is the language, what we define as domestic violence, and that included things like coercive control. Could you talk about just some of the recent law changes in Connecticut better protecting these victims?
Of course. So as of October 1st of 2021, in Connecticut now, when someone is obtaining a restraining order, they can obtain a restraining order based on coercive controlling behaviors. And that can be sort of a confusing thing for people. Most people, when they think about domestic violence, think of physical violence. But domestic violence is really a pattern of controlling behaviors to prevent a victim from leaving that perpetrator. And so that is what the change in the definition is allowing victims now to address through the civil court when obtaining a restraining order. So things like financial abuse and preventing a victim from having any access to the family finances, continuous threats to remove someone's children from their care, using someone's immigration status against them to prevent them from leaving the relationship, things like that, anything that prevents that victim from leaving and makes them even more isolated from their friends and family.
Mm-hmm. What about anything else that has been addressed even in recent years, even in the last 10 years? I know Connecticut, would you say Connecticut is one of the better off states when it comes to protection for these victims, or are we in the middle? Like, what, in your professional opinion, where does Connecticut lie with protection?
I do feel like we are on the more progressive end in terms of providing protections and support for victims of domestic violence. We do tend to get a good bit of bipartisan support for a lot of our initiatives and proposed legislation. Some of the other recent changes in the last decade or so is we did pass legislation that helped to prevent dual arrests in Connecticut. So a lot of times, the way the language of the previous statute was written, the police didn't really have a choice when they showed up to a scene if both parties were accusing the other party of doing something to them. So we amended the statute with language that gives the police the opportunity to identify the primary aggressor. So we have seen a significant decrease in the number of dual arrests where victims end up getting arrested at the same time as the perpetrator, which can obviously be very damaging and prevent victims from seeking help in the future.
We're chatting this morning with Angela Schlinghide, who is the Center for Family Justice's Director of Civil Legal Services and Criminal Court Advocacy, talking about the protections in order for domestic violence victims here in Connecticut. What do you think, in your opinion, Angela, is lacking for victims? Where do you think we're missing the boat?
So I think a lot of the things that are still lacking aren't necessarily things that can be dealt with by passing new laws. It's more about prevention and education. The laws are there. It's how we apply them in criminal court, in the family court. That's where we need to focus on making sure everyone understands these dynamics of domestic violence and how they play out in these different scenarios. So I think I think we can, we are trying and we are working towards more education and more prevention work, especially working with kids, breaking that cycle of violence before these kids grow up to be either abusers or victims themselves. That is how we're truly going to break the cycle.
So what do you mean when you say in family court, for example, that we should be like doing better? I mean, do you find that we're prosecuting cases correctly right now?
Well, you know, family court is dealing with the divorces and the custody and child support matters. And this statute is relatively new in terms of the coercive controlling language and including it in the definition of domestic violence. So, you know, everybody is on a learning curve. There's, you know, everyone's trying to figure out what this means in the context of a family law case. How do we apply it? From a judge's perspective, they have to take the best interests of the children and remain objective at the same time. So it's really about just providing as much education to the people who are in the position to make those decisions so that they have a real true understanding of what victims are experiencing and, you know, the abusive patterns of control and manipulation that offenders will use, oftentimes using the court system as another form of abuse.
We're chatting this morning with Angela. Angela is a civil legal services and criminal court advocacy, the director, I should say, for the Center for Family Justice. Angela Schlingheide is here. So, Angela, you were saying that, you know, we have all the laws in place. We've got what we need here in Connecticut, but it comes down to education. And I know sometimes we sort of wait until, unfortunately, it's too late. Are there things that you would professionally like to see done? So, for example, and look, maybe I'm outside of the box and that's perfectly fine. Correct me. That's why I have this show, is I have no problem being corrected. But like I think about, for example, in our home, before my husband and I got married, we did premarital classes. And it doesn't have to be religious per se. I'm not saying you have to take religious classes, but you know, with domestic violence, sometimes it's married couples, sometimes it's people who co-live together, whatever it may be. But do you think that there are enough even non-denominational classes for premarital to detect if, hey, you know what, maybe there's something not right here, or, you know, to have professionals intervene before there could be a bad situation? I know we look to the schools a lot. And of course, we can always improve on that. But, you know, that's something that sticks out in my mind. I know my husband and I, we never were ever had issues like that. But, you know, just disagreements on things that could have easily ruined our marriage. But thankfully, we went to premarital. We went to counseling, for example. So I'm wondering, you know, I know if you belong to a church, that's something required. But anyone who doesn't essentially just enters a relationship and hopes and prays that they've got support. And if they don't, well, they're going to go with their heart on this one. So I'm wondering if that sector is being looked at enough. Do you think it would make a difference?
So there are a lot of points of intervention where we can educate people about, you know, healthy relationships and, you know, red flags and things to look for when you meet someone that might indicate that they could potentially be an abusive partner. Our coalition, Connecticut Coalition Against Domestic Violence, works closely with all of the member agencies on developing these different types of initiatives. So things like working with the schools, like you said, is, you know, an obvious one. But in the past few years, they've developed initiatives trying to work with healthcare providers across the state to really educate them about ways to incorporate screening into their intakes with their patients. Also, we're trying to have more of it come into the workplace. So we do sexual harassment training, for instance, at, you know, most companies, it's a requirement. We're trying to change the law so that there's more training around understanding domestic violence, how to, you know, if you're a victim yourself, but also as a bystander, if a coworker, or someone who works for you or with you, you know, discloses something, how do you handle that? How do you help that person? Things like that. So there are always places and points of intervention that we can increase to get the word out there. You know, most of the agencies like ours, the Center for Family Justice, we have a training institute. So corporations, businesses can hire us to come in and do training for them. Schools, we do a lot of work in the schools, things like that.
So And you know, it's interesting. You had mentioned, like, at doctor's offices, I've noticed that. When did they start asking that question in doctor's offices? Like, I've noticed, for example, if I go to an annual appointment, they will ask, first of all, not only do they ask you, you know, doctors I've known since I was 12 years old, they'll now ask me if I'm safe at home, if my husband's ever, I mean, they ask me all these questions now every single time I go in, which I don't remember that being a thing. But the other thing I've noticed too is that female doctors will now always ask if I feel comfortable being alone with my doctor or if they need to be present in the room, which I also don't remember being a thing. Do you know when that started changing?
So it's been, I want to say, the last maybe 3 to 4 years.
Yeah, so it's new. It's newish, I should say.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, there's always, of course, there's always doctors, you know, who've done this. But in terms of getting a widespread net where we're trying to bring that education to as many people in the medical profession as possible, it's definitely been a focus over the last 3 to 4 years. CCADV has really moved that initiative forward. And you can see it when you go to the doctor, like you said, you're seeing the results of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it certainly is making a difference. And I've noticed it. I've certainly noticed it. And I thought, wow, all right, that's a big thing, that if you're asking even teenagers those kinds of questions, like, are you dating? Are, you know, do they ever get physical? You know, things like that. I think those are just questions that immediately put you sort of in the mindset of, oh, why are they asking this? And what does this mean? And, you know, opening up another avenue where you can talk about it and know about it earlier rather than later. So I've noticed that.
Exactly.
Personally. Yeah. It's interesting. Angela Schillingheide, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show this morning. If anyone wants to contact the Center for Family Justice or talk to you, is there a way they could do that?
Yes. So they can call our main office number, which is 203-334-6154. That is the way to contact us directly. They can also contact Faith Connect through CCADV, which I don't have the number memorized right now, but it's on all of our websites and CCADV's website, ctcadv.org.
Angela, you've been such a pleasure, and I appreciate all the information you've given us this morning. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me, and I just want to say we are having our Walk a Mile in Her Shoes for Sexual Assault and Child Abuse Awareness Month on Saturday in Fairfield. We would encourage everyone to come out 8 o'clock in the morning to register and walk with us to support survivors.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And we're actually going to have Gary McNamara on the show this Friday, who's the chairperson of the event. So we're very excited for it. And thank you again so much, Angela. We appreciate
it. Thank you for having me. Have a great day.
You too. So we hear a lot about pilot burnout post-pandemic. And this morning we learned about a type of doctor that is also being added to the list. Veterinarians, pet owners increased substantially during the pandemic, especially in that first year. And it was actually reported about 23 million people adopted a pet during the 2020 year. So with all those people at home, you can imagine they're spotting things wrong with their pets and they are running to the vets. So what do we do for them? This morning, I wanted to talk to our family vet, Dr. Christie in Fairfield of Engelberg Christie Animal Hospital, and get his perspective on this. Good morning, Dr. Christie. Thanks for being here. How are you?
Good morning. I'm doing fine. How about you?
I'm fine, thank you. I know for myself, during the pandemic, coming to visit your offices, you guys had a full system with a drop-off system and everything. And a few times there, I know I would look at Derek and I'd think, wow, I don't know. I just saw you guys going in and out, so busy. You were booked out months in advance. Did you feel the vet burnout, is what they're calling it? Did you feel that?
Everybody felt it, not only vets, everybody in the medical profession, restaurants, waiters. But yes, COVID is really, we didn't have clients come in the office for a year. So everything was done remote, in the parking lot, over the phone. And medicine's a full contact sport. I need a client there. I'd like the owner there. We can talk. We can show. We can point out. And the animals, I get a much better history when I'm there with the owner as opposed to on the phone. And even the time restraints, when people could just come in and out of the office without masks and isolation, we could see people much more efficiently. Office calls used to be, you know, 20 minutes or so. And when with COVID and outpatient and everything in the parking lot, they took 40, 50 minutes apiece, which made us much less efficient. Mm-hmm. And it's tough doing remote medicine. But one day at a time, we got through it, and now we are, you know, slowly opening up, and people are coming in the office, and so we're on the upswing at this point.
So what did you do, Dr. Christie, to kind of stay, you know, calm and keep it together, collect yourself? Like, how did you do it?
Well, all of us, one day at a time, one thing at a time. We do the best we can. We try to just, you know, take it as it comes. I mean, you can be as upset as you want to be and move on, or just move on. And so we chose to, you know, do the best we can with what we could. And there was a fair amount of mutual support where we, you know, all help each other, you know, get through the day. And we did.
Yeah,
I am blessed with a really good staff.
You do have
real
a good staff.
Dedicated staff,
yeah.
Who's very flexible, and we, you know, they go out of their way to help. And, you know, if we all pull together, we got through it.
Mm-hmm. We're chatting this morning with Dr. Christie of Engelberg Christie Animal Hospital in Fairfield, very popular vet in southwestern Connecticut. In fact, he does all of our animals, has been doing them since my mom was a little girl. And I learned this morning about what's called veterinarian burnout. So, you know, in talking about this a little bit, they said that this report I was reading was talking about dealing with fatigue, empathy, overload, and they created what's called the Veterinary Mental Health Initiative. Do you have any recollection of, like, getting emails or anything, any notifications about this initiative?
Quite a few.
Really?
And at lots of different levels. In the journals, there's lots of articles about taking care of yourself and working together and being safe. The associations have put together mental health councils and maybe some hotlines or social support groups. The veterinary community has been very responsive to the mental health. I mean, veterinarians get into the business for medicine, to help animals. And when you're backlogged, when you can't do what you would like to do over and over and over again, and people can't come in to see you and they want to see you, and, you know, your schedule is booked, that's a stress. You know, we want to make everybody happy and healthy. So there is a lot of support in the veterinary community right now.
Which is beautiful, Dr. Christie. I mean, I'm glad to hear that. I'm curious, when you saw such an uptick in people adopting pets and having them in their homes, how many of the calls would you say you had to, you had to answer that had to do with, like, pet anxiety? I'm always curious about that, because there was, like, the separation anxiety, people working from home for over a year, and then all of a sudden the pets being like, wait, where'd you go?
Yeah, that's kind of the after effect of COVID.
Mm-hmm.
When everybody was staying home, adopting pets because you had nothing else to do, you were homebound, what a great time to get a pet. The animals got used to people being around 24/7. Now that things seem to be opening up, people going back, animals haven't experienced that. And if they didn't grow up with, you know, mom and dad leaving the house in the morning, going to work, coming back, or going to school and coming back, we've dealt with quite a bit more separation anxiety and referrals to trainers and behaviorists, and just talking about how you can help the animal adapt to you going back to whatever this new normal is. But yeah, this is kind of a rebound effect from the COVID, where everybody's going back to, you know, leaving the animal for a bit. But we're working on that, and we're getting through it.
And I'm curious, Dr. Christie, how long have you been in practice?
Oh, 38 years, I believe.
So in your, you know, years of working in this industry, have you ever remembered a time where there was this overload, this burnout for the veterinarian community?
Actually, no. I mean, this is a new phenomena, and I think it's a phenomenon not only for veterinarians. I think it's for industry. How many industries are looking for help? It seems to be right now that there is a sort of a lack of sort of professionals. Veterinarians are in short supply now. They're in great demand. People are having a hard time filling positions. And the same thing's happening in physicians' offices and ophthalmology offices. I mean, it's kind of a universal, I think, medical situation.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Christie, if anybody, and not that you need the patient load, I know you've got enough, but if anyone wants to meet you and bring their furry friends to you for a checkup or for a consultation or anything like that, where are you located? What's your number?
181 Kings Highway in Fairfield, and our number's 203 267-4475.
Dr. Christie, thank you so much. I think I owe you a visit soon with one of my obnoxious animals. I don't know which one. Probably Olaf. I don't know.
Happy to see you, whoever it is.
I know, right? Thank you, Dr. Christie. Always a
pleasure
to chat. All right, appreciate it. April is Parkinson's Awareness Month, and according to national data, about 1 million Americans are thought to have Parkinson's, which is more than the people affected by multiple sclerosis, muscular dystrophy, and ALS combined. Every year, about 60,000 Americans are diagnosed with Parkinson's. So for this, we wanted to talk a little bit about it and understand the diagnosis, why it's so important to detect it early. And for that, we wanted to talk to movement disorder neurologist Dr. Leon Mayton, who is with St. Vincent's Medical Center. And good morning to you, Dr. Mayton. Thank you so much for being here. How are you?
Oh, good morning. Thank you for having me.
So first of all, explain to people if they're not totally familiar. You hear about Parkinson's a lot, but sometimes it can get confusing when you talk about ALS and some of these other illnesses. What is Parkinson's? Explain it to us.
So, yeah, Parkinson's is a very common neurological disorder that's seen primarily in older individuals, although you can really get it at any age. And it tends to lead to a lot of tremors, balance problems, stiffness, slowness in kind of day-to-day tasks. It takes longer to perform various tasks. And it's really a brain disorder. The muscles themselves are perfectly fine, but there's a disconnect between what the brain wants to do and what the muscles actually do. And it's something that's becoming more and more recognized, I think. And I don't know if it's necessarily more common, but it's more evident now.
And who would you say is most at risk? Like, do more men get it than women? Is it about even? And you said age kind of plays a factor in it.
Yeah, men are a little bit more likely than women to have Parkinson's. And it's typically seen, the average age of diagnosis is probably anywhere from about 50 to 75. Although I have some patients who are in their 90s who are newly diagnosed, and I have some as early in their 30s who are diagnosed. And, you know, for those who know who Michael J. Fox was, he was, I believe, in his 40s when he was diagnosed with Parkinson. So the age really varies, although the retirement age is typically where we start seeing most of the symptoms.
Now, what if you're somebody who already has, like, the shakes or tremors, as you mentioned? Does that necessarily mean you have Parkinson's?
Not necessarily. There are a lot of different causes of tremor. It really depends on the type of tremor that they have and other associated symptoms. The type of tremor that we see in Parkinson's is very unique in that it's what's called a resting tremor, meaning that the tremor is primarily there when somebody's hands or legs are completely at rest. So typically what patients tell me is, or their spouses really tell me is, you know, my husband was watching TV and I see that his hands start shaking a lot. That's a very common explanation for a Parkinson's tremor. It's at rest. And the second they go to use their hands and activate those muscles, the tremor actually goes away a little bit. And so that's a very important distinction between a Parkinson's tremor and some of the other tremor types that are out there.
Now, with Parkinson's, do you have risk factors? Like, do genetics play a really big part in this, or are there other risk factors we should know?
So we're not fully sure on a lot of the risk factors. You know, we know that pesticides and certain chemicals do play a role, although that certainly doesn't explain the full story. You know, there are a lot of farmers and other professions that use pesticides on a regular basis and don't necessarily get Parkinson's. But we do know that it certainly increases the risk. And similar to Agent Orange over in Vietnam, that has certainly increased the risk of Parkinson's. But there are plenty of individuals who are exposed that never had Parkinson's. And then genetics, we think, may play a role, but we don't really know what specific genes lead to Parkinson's. Mm. There are a few out there that we know increase the risk of Parkinson's. But the interesting thing is you can have an abnormal gene that may lead to Parkinson's and not have any symptoms of Parkinson's ever.
Wait,
so
how does
really
that work? How does that work? How do you have Parkinson's but you don't have any symptoms?
So there's certain genes that increase the risk of getting Parkinson's, mm-hmm. but just because you have that abnormal gene doesn't mean that you'll actually end up having that disease.
I see what you're
it's
saying.
Something
okay.
called penetrance.
Okay.
And so that's why we think there's a lot of different factors that go along with it. And because there are certain genes that run in families, and, you know, the kids have the abnormal gene, but they never, ever get Parkinson's disease. But others do.
Wow.
So that's why we think there's a lot of components to it. And it's not just one thing that really causes the Parkinson's.
What about head injuries, Dr. Maton? Because sometimes we'll see, especially football players, end up getting Parkinson's. Are there any connections to head injuries? I've seen studies where they've suggested it, but it hasn't been proven per se.
Exactly. And it's, a lot of it is a suggestion. There's really no way to prove it because it's just a common disease in general. I certainly see patients who have a history of boxing and wrestling and football, but the majority of people who have those injuries never get Parkinson's. So once again, it's just an increased risk, and certainly the more you injure your head, the more likely you are to have various neurological conditions. But really, at the heart of Parkinson's disease, the head injuries themselves would not be sufficient to explain it. So maybe they have a genetic predisposition to Parkinson's, and then they play football and get injuries, and then maybe they're exposed to a pesticide, and all that combined ultimately leads to Parkinson's.
Interesting. According to the Parkinson's Foundation, more than 10 million people worldwide are currently living with Parkinson's disease, and nearly 1 million are living with it right now in the United States this year. So we're chatting with Dr. Maton this morning of St. Vincent's Medical Center, a movement disorder neurologist. And I'm curious, Dr. Maton, detection early, I would think like any other disease, it's so important. Can you tell us why?
Yes, and I think in Parkinson's particularly, I mean, maybe I'm just biased, but I think it's extremely important to detect it early for a few reasons. I mean, for one, the earlier we're able to detect the disease, the sooner we can get started with appropriate treatment. And the earlier we start treatment, it's been shown to have a better quality of life at the end. And part of it is, you know, exercise and physical therapy is crucial in Parkinson's to prevent falls. And the sooner we can start that, the better that people do, the less memory problems they have, the less medications they require, the less falls, the less injury, and just overall the better quality of life they're able to attain.
So how old can you be to start checking for that, and how exactly do you detect early stages of Parkinson's?
So there are some things that are what's called nonspecific symptoms that we tend to see in Parkinson's that should kind of raise a red flag that maybe should be checked. So one is changes in your handwriting. So oftentimes patients with Parkinson's will note that even before their tremor starts, their handwriting will become smaller and less legible. Another one that we often hear is that their sleep patterns change. So not only does their sleep get worse, but they start having very vivid dreams. They sometimes start even acting out their dreams, sometimes even falling out of bed. And this can happen 5 or 10 years before some of the physical symptoms start. A third thing that I often see, which, you know, it can happen in a lot of conditions, but it's very common in Parkinson's, is constipation. People with Parkinson's, before they have any physical symptoms, will almost always develop constipation. So if it's something that you've never had before and then all of a sudden develop it, particularly if you have any of the other findings, it might be a reason to get checked for Parkinson's.
So how old, I'm sorry, I must have missed that part. How old should you start to get checked?
So there's no specific age requirement. It really depends on these symptoms. So regardless of your age, if you develop these symptoms, you should definitely talk to your doctor to see if this could potentially be Parkinson's and if they need to refer you to a movement disorder specialist. We don't really have screenings like we do in colon cancer for colonoscopies, for example.
Sure.
That doesn't really exist in Parkinson's. There's no age specifically that someone needs to be checked, because realistically, if they don't have any of these symptoms, there's no way to check for Parkinson's in these individuals.
Got it.
They have to develop the symptoms to be checked.
Okay. I understand what you're saying. Okay. All right. We're talking to Dr. Leon Maton, who is the movement disorder neurologist and specializes in Parkinson's disease. I'm curious. So for treatment, you were kind of saying get into physical therapy as soon as possible. That's why early detection is so key. What other treatments and latest advancements have come on the medical scene for Parkinson's patients?
So the primary method of treatment in Parkinson's is actually replacing the dopamine that they're missing. So one of the hallmark features of Parkinson's is that parts of the brain stop producing dopamine. And we think dopamine is really what leads to most of the Parkinson's symptoms. So a lot of the medications that we have now are ways of either replacing dopamine or boosting dopamine or allowing it to stick around longer in the brain. And so that's the primary method of treating Parkinson's, and it works very, very well. However, research and clinical trials now are looking to more or less fix the underlying problem by either replacing the dopamine cells that are dying off or by stopping the accumulation of various proteins that we think may kind of clog up the brain that may lead to Parkinson's symptoms. There's also many surgical treatments that we're looking at, as well as some of the genetic possibilities in Parkinson's disease.
Well, Dr. Maton, is there a way that people can, as you mentioned, it would be something that if you went to your doctor and they said, hey, I think you should go see a specialist, that's when they'd probably contact people like you. But if anybody does want to contact you, is there a way they could do it or learn more about this?
Yes, absolutely. So we're located right here in Stamford on 623 Newfield Avenue. And the number to our office is, let me actually get that for you. So it's 860-870-6385. And you can call for an appointment there.
Okay. Dr. Maton, we so appreciate you coming on this morning and giving us all this information. Thank you so much.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Dr. Leon Maton, who is a movement disorder neurologist specializing in Parkinson's for Parkinson's Awareness Month, learning all the details about that diagnosis here on WICC.
Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600.
I am so excited for this next guest to be on the show with us. Elizabeth Weisel is a four-time Olympic gold and bronze medalist, the 2016 Team USA captain, and world record holder for the first woman to successfully swim from mainland Rhode Island to Block Island. Yeah, I have so many questions for this woman. And she's going to be coming to Darien very soon. Elizabeth is here, though, right now over the phone. And thank you so much for taking the time to come on this morning, Elizabeth. Appreciate it. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Okay, I just have to ask you this question because I don't even think I can maybe like swim a mile. I look at people who do triathlons and I think to myself, I don't even know how you do it. Rhode Island to Block Island? First of all, how far is that and how do you even train for that? That's unbelievable.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I think triathletes as well are also crazy, so I don't necessarily couple myself with them. So I'm on your side with that, but no, Rhode Island to Block Island is 12 and a half miles, about 20 kilometers. And I pretty much spent the entire summer last year swimming 2 to 4 hours every single day, working out in the gym, going on long runs and walks. Because it's not like a race. You know what I mean? Like mm-hmm. all I needed to do was finish. So it didn't really matter how fast I was going, just as long as I had the endurance to do it. But yeah, it was something that I'm definitely not going to do again. I'll say that.
You were like one and done. I did it. We're done with this.
Exactly.
That's so funny. So what made you want to do that?
So it was for a cause near and dear to my heart. And my dad was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer in December of 2020. Thank you. And I kind of wanted to give him something to look forward to. And so I had worked really closely with Swim Across America, which is a nonprofit organization actually coming to Darien this weekend. And they host swims across the country. And all of the money raised from those swims go towards cancer research and clinical trials. And so for me, it was like, oh my gosh, I can do something really monumental, you know, get some notoriety for my dad, for Swim Across America, raise some really critical funds for the cancer fighting community. That's exactly why I did it. And Swim Across America has just been such a huge support system for not only me, but my dad, my whole family throughout his diagnosis and stuff. So it was a really special swim for me.
Oh, that's so beautiful. And what a tribute to your dad. That is so cool. I love that. So when did you do that swim from Rhode Island to Block Island?
So that swim was at the end of September last year. And we actually had to cancel it about 4 times due to weather because, as we all know, living in New England, you know, hurricane season is end of August, yep. early September, and that's when the water is warm enough for me to swim. So I couldn't be in a wetsuit for it to be an official crossing. Those are just like the Marathon Swimming Federation rules.
Oh, I didn't know that.
So we were really up against the clock, you know, trying to get it in while still having conditions that were suitable for me to cross. But we ended up getting it done in end of September, and I'm very happy that it's over, for sure.
Yeah, that's unbelievable. That really is. I when I think about it, like when you just said 12 and a half miles, and I think to myself, like, I just ran a 5K this past weekend and my legs are still recovering. And I think that's on land and just legs. I don't know. I don't know how you did that.
I don't know.
I just don't know how you did
it. I understand.
Oh, my gosh. That's a beautiful thing. We're talking this morning to Elizabeth Beisel, who not only was the first woman to successfully swim from mainland Rhode Island to Block Island, but also is an Olympic medalist. Talk about your experience going to the Olympics. I mean, that's something that most athletes, they dream of, but they never get to that level.
Yeah, I'm super fortunate to have been to three Olympics. So I had very different experiences each time. And, you know, to be able to stand on a podium representing your country and just honestly seeing the hard work that you've put in and the dedication and the sacrifice come to fruition. It's such an incredible feeling that's hard to put into words. But the amount of people that you get to meet just from being at the Olympic Games from all over the world is such an incredible thing. And it really does bring the world together. It's such a peaceful place to be. You know, everybody there has so much respect for each other. And to be honest, it's probably more fun to compete at the trials or at the Olympics than it is the trials, because Olympic trials, you know, your dream of becoming an Olympian is on the line. So kind of like once you make it to the Olympics, you're just there to have fun and, you know, prove to yourself that you can do what you really have dreamed of your entire life. So it was a great experience.
What is it like, Elizabeth, being in an Olympic pool? And why I ask that question is because I have to be honest. So I love the Olympics. Love it. Love it so much. The swimming stresses me out so much because it is literally milliseconds where people are a fingertip away from first, second, third place. And I watch it and I'll watch the replays and be like, nope, there's no way. And then you watch it. It is as a watcher, as a viewer, I think swimming is one of the most exciting Olympic sports. What is it like in the pool? Like, what is it like for you in the pool while you're competing against these incredible other athletes?
Yeah, obviously nerve-wracking, but it's also at the same time just something that you've done your entire life. So you're kind of used to it. And once you're pretty well established on that world stage, you kind of know how everybody else races from around the world. So for me, in the middle of a race, I'm, of course, thinking about my own race strategy and focusing on how I'm feeling during the race. Like, am I a little bit tired right now? Should I let up or should I make my move now? But you're right. It comes down to hundredths of a second. And in the sport of swimming, you know, as Olympic swimmers, our pretty much livelihood depends on whether we have medals or not. So if you're fourth by 1/100th of a second and you don't come home with an Olympic medal, you're not going to get the sponsors that you could have gotten had you won that medal. So it's really, really hard, you know, being a swimmer, because we have our chance to shine once every 4 years. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, to be honest, nobody really cares about swimming the other 3 years. So the Olympics, we're not the NFL. We're not MLS.
Like, I know what you mean.
Not soccer. Yeah. So we're very aware of the fact that, like, the Olympic Games is our time to really prove ourselves to the world, you know, get those sponsorships to help us pay for our bills and stuff, because, you know, there's not really that much money in swimming. So there's a lot of factors that tie into the nerves and the pressure that, you know, an athlete needs to perform at the Olympics, but it's at the end of the day, it's the sport that you love, and hopefully that's why everybody is doing it, and that's certainly why I was doing it.
This weekend, there's such an amazing opportunity happening at the Darien YMCA. Saturday, April 23rd, there's going to be a swim clinic at the Darien Y. And then there's also going to be a meet and greet later on. And it's very exciting because it is free. It's open to the public. And it's featuring two incredible swimmers, including Elizabeth Beisel, who's here this morning. And Elizabeth, tell us, you know, why come to Connecticut? What is the purpose of this? And what are you most excited for?
Yeah, so we're coming to Connecticut to hold a clinic in Darien. It's actually the hometown of Swim Across America's co-founder, Matt Vossler. And it's home of one of the biggest Swim Across America swims. And for those of you listening that don't know what Swim Across America is, it's a nonprofit organization. They hold swims across the country, and all of the money raised at those swims go towards cancer research and clinical trials. So we're putting on a free clinic this weekend on Saturday from 12 to 1. There's a meet and greet. So I will have my Olympic medals. I can sign autographs, take photos. And it's all going to a cause that, you know, I hold personally really near and dear to my heart. And unfortunately, most people do, because cancer does touch so many of us.
Mm-hmm. It's so true. So be sure to go and check it out. Again, it's at the Darien YMCA. A really quick question before I let you go, Elizabeth. Where do you leave your medals? I always wonder that. Where do people put their medals when they're done? Like, are they on display somewhere? Are they hidden in like a treasure box? Where do you put them?
Yeah, so it's not as glamorous as you think. You know, they're honestly just collecting dust in all of our homes until we take them out, which is why I love, like, coming to places like Darien and sharing them with you guys. But I think they're just sitting on a bookshelf right now at my mom's house. Like, my boyfriend made me this really awesome wooden box to hold them in. But other than that, you know, I don't really ever take them out and, like, wear them around the town.
I guess it makes sense. Like, it's not, you're right. Why would you, you know, be like, oh, I'm going grocery shopping, let me just wear my medal. You know, it's not, yeah. It makes sense. No, I always was curious, like, do you, I don't know, because you see sometimes, like, where people will put, you know, trophies or, you know, whatever, records on display. And I always wonder, where do Olympians put their medals? But, all right, you just kind of let it chill, you know, until you got to go bring it somewhere.
There you go.
I love it. I love the honesty. And Elizabeth, you have been such a blast. Thank you so much. And we're so looking forward to having you here in Connecticut in a matter of days. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Melissa. I appreciate it.